Good morning. I call the Commerce Finance Policy Committee to order on Tuesday, April 7th. There is a quorum present. Representative Finke, would you, may I have a motion to approve the minutes from Thursday, March 26th, 2026?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, first order of business, Representative Elkins. Welcome to the committee. Our first item of business is House File 4456, before us with the intent to move to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. I also understand, Representative Elkins, you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. And the amendment just reflects suggested changes in wording that come from the Attorney General's office, and I have Sarah Doctori from the AG's Data Privacy Enforcement Team with me to help answer questions.
Is there any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members, this bill adds a section to the end of the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Rights Act, establishing a data broker registry. I'm sorry.
Oh, can you pull the mic closer to you, please?
Yeah, I don't think I can get it much closer. Can you? Is this a little better?
Or speak a little bit louder.
Okay, maybe that's it.
There we go.
Okay, it adds a section to the back end of the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act to establish a data broker registry like those that already exist in Texas, California, Oregon, and Vermont. Is it working better?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So right now for enforcement, we're pretty much limited to getting tips or reading the 404 blog or articles in Wired magazine in order to figure out where we should be devoting our enforcement activity. So what these other states have already done, and we're pretty much trying to mirror California to be able to take advantage, leverage some of the resources that they've developed for this, is to have the companies that are where we're most concerned about compliance, the companies that actually buy, sell, process our data, to register with the state so that the Attorney General's office knows where our points of vulnerability are, essentially. And lucky enough to attend the annual International Association of Privacy Professionals in D.C. last week, where this topic was devoted to. It was a whole panel devoted to this, and we're trying to give the AG's office a better tool to be able to identify companies that need greater scrutiny.
Thank you. And I see we have testifiers here. So first up, Sarah Doctori, Assistant Attorney General. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Assistant Attorney General Sarah Doctori.
Can you please move the mic close to you?
Yeah,
sorry.
That's difficult.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Assistant Attorney General Sarah Doctori. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Division focused on data privacy. As Representative Elkins noted, the data broker registry proposed in House File 4456 would be an incredibly useful tool to assist the Office of the Minnesota Attorney General in its enforcement of the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act. It would also be, I think, even potentially a more important and more critical tool to support Minnesotan consumers in vindicating their own rights under that act, to understand the entities that are collecting and selling their data, and to be able to enforce the rights that have been granted to them under current Minnesota law. As Representative Elkins noted, I'm happy to answer any technical questions the committee may have regarding the proposed data broker registry, how it would interact with the MCDPA. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions to this testifier? I do have one. Mm-hmm. Would this kind of broker list help us track surveillance pricing as well, or make sure that our data is protected against some of the surveillance pricing we're seeing?
It's a very good question. Surveillance pricing has a little bit of a complicated nexus with personal data. I would say that there are many cases in which broad collection of personal consumer data, broad collection of facilitates and assists with surveillance pricing. So it's a little bit of an attenuated relationship, but further empowering Minnesota consumers to restrict when profiles are being built about them and the kind of profiling that can ultimately happen is one way that consumers may be able to kind of undermine the nature of surveillance pricing that I think we're starting to see as a possibility. But I will say it's a little bit of an attenuated relationship there.
Thank you. I know when I go to, you know, like a silly story on Facebook or something like that, you have to go through and manage all of the cookies. Would this make it so that it would like apply across the internet, or would you have to still go in and like, you know, unclick all those boxes every time you click into a story?
So this is relatively narrow legislation. Minnesota consumers have really important rights under the Data Privacy Act to, you know, allow, require to write to entities and request deletion, correction of data. There are a variety of requirements applicable to entities that collect data, which relate to the boxes that you often see. What this would do would be creating a data registry, or a data broker registry of entities that are buying and selling consumer data, so that consumers may be aware of who is buying and selling their personal data. I think the phrase that I've heard sometimes is smokeless fires, that there are entities that are really trafficking in broad levels of consumer data and buying and selling it. But consumers don't know where to send the request to say, please correct this, please delete this, because the data has already been sold from the entity that they may have interacted with. This tells them who to contact. So certainly there still will be opt-out boxes, opt-in boxes. You would still see that portion of kind of the consumer data privacy landscape. But this would be another simply a mechanism, I think, of visibility for consumers to understand and be empowered to vindicate their own rights. And certainly if I've said anything that Representative Elkins thinks should be added to, he will do that, basically
yeah,
building.
Under the Consumer Data Privacy Act, consumers do have a right to know who the companies that they do business with sell their data to. But they really have little visibility now to who those companies might be selling it to.
So building transparency into the system. It's wonderful.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Hewitt.
So I'm, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins, for bringing this bill. I'm kind of curious, and help me with this if the AG knows or if Representative Elkins might know. Realtors, when they come in, they take a lot of data, right, because they need to know what they're dealing with on your house and stuff like that. That data gets registered with another company called the MLS. Is that realtor responsible to say that the MLS can share this data, or is that up to the MLS to say that? It's an industry that has this kind of situation happening in it. And so I'm kind of curious if you can explain just on that base level of what happens there in situations like this, because it can go medical, EMS, stuff like that too. So,
thank you. We do have one testifier after this too, so they might be able to answer more questions. But if you'd like to answer, Ms. Doctory.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Cagle. Thank you, Representative. My read of this amendment is that it would be the data brokers would be entities that are buying, and my understanding of how the MLSs work is that it's an organization that compiles this data. But as far as I am aware, I do not believe that the main MLSs in Minnesota are purchasing that data from realtors. So I struggle to see how an MLS would be considered a data broker. Under this current legislation, if they're not purchasing that data and then reselling it, which I simply don't understand to be kind of the function of an MLS. So again, Representative Elkins will correct me if I have any read of that incorrect.
Yeah, in its current form, the act, thank you, Madam Chair, deals with the sale of data, not the sharing of data.
Thank you. And Representative Dodsett, I do have you. Do you want to wait until the next testifier? Okay, thank you. All right, next up we have Zachary Taylor, Director of Government Relations at Consumer Data Industry Association online, I'm assuming. Welcome
yes,
to the committee. Yep, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Wonderful, thank you. My name is Zachary Taylor. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Consumer Data Industry Association. We represent the consumer reporting industry, which covers the three national credit bureaus, specialty credit bureaus, background check companies, tenant screeners, and companies who are engaged in identity verification, fraud detection, vehicle recall, and other pro-consumer activities. First and foremost, we do want to appreciate the sponsor for his work on this issue and for the willingness to work with CDIA when the initial data privacy statute was adopted. It includes important exemptions for data flows that our member companies work with that are already tightly regulated by federal laws. This includes the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, among others, as well as important use case exemptions related to fraud detection or employment. It also appropriately treats public records. As we look at today's proposal, we are concerned that the intent of this bill to bring forward those exemptions into the data broker piece is not actually going to be achieved with the current structure. We would like to work with the sponsor and the committee to make sure that happens. Our concern, of course, is that those exemptions in the data privacy statute exempt the data that our member companies work with from the consumer rights created therein, largely because those rights are already covered by, for example, the provisions in the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act that govern how and when consumers can access their information, correct it if it's inaccurate as well. But in the consumer reporting context, I think it's clear the risk of providing consumers the opportunity to delete their data would undermine the completeness and accuracy of consumer reports we all use to mitigate and identify risk. Our perspective is that, you know, for these companies who are working with exempt data but are not subject to an entity-level exemption, they would be required to register with the Attorney General's office. But that could be confusing to consumers because the data flows and activities they work with, including in some instances the sale, would not be covered by the data privacy statute. We believe that's a mismatch. And we would point to California's registry where only 500 out of the millions of companies who process and sell consumer data have to register. That's both a very large list for consumers to work through, but also a very small portion of companies who are actually engaged in this activity. So we're concerned about the scope here, and we'd like to, if possible, see the bill amended to better reflect how the underlying data privacy statute treats what data is covered and what data is not, to ensure that consumers have a clear understanding of what their rights are in relation to this data and when other statutes, whether it be FCRA or GLBA or DBPA, govern those activities. We think this is a way to improve the bill and ensure that there's clarity instead of confusion. Happy to stand for any questions at this time. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Well, just one moment, Representative Elkins. Is there any other members of the public that are wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. I'm Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I would be happy to work with the CDIA between now and when the bill is heard in judiciary. I'm a little bit puzzled because the act does include broad exemptions for data that is already covered under the Fair Credit Reporting Act and Graham-Leach-Bliley. And it seems to me that most of the activities that the CDI members engage in would be covered under those two acts, probably federal laws, possibly others. So I'm a little puzzled, but I'm happy to work with the CDIA members to any changes that need to be made to clarify the clarify their concerns and address
Thank
them.
Thank you. Representative Dodsett.
I'm good.
Oh, okay. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for either the testifier on Zoom or maybe somebody at the desk, but I'm just curious because the testifier said that the similar legislation in California, basically there are millions of data brokers and 500 of them registered with the Attorney General's office. And I would like to know if that, if the solution to this is to have all of them register with the Attorney General's office, or is the solution to have fewer? Like, I want to know, because I don't want these millions of data brokers doing unregulated work with our data. We are products that are being sold without any contact with any part of that process. So it feels to me like there shouldn't be millions, but if there are, they should all register themselves. So I guess my question is that, is the concern being raised here, which direction are they trying to go to slow this bill?
I don't know if Representative Elkins or Mr.
I think I can address. So I met with the people who run the California brokery register when I was in Washington. They at this point have 566 entities registered. They are, basically willing to share their software. Either they've talked about either making their software, their code open source so that other states can just adopt it, and they've also talked about having a single registry that other states could use, have basically partitioned so that brokerages would essentially only have to file in one place, in order to minimize the burden and make sure that the resulting registry would be as the coverage would be as expansive as necessary. So this is something that is actively being worked on. There's a tremendous amount of cooperation among states on these and other issues. Actually, it was a whole panel at this conference I attended that was all representatives of enforcement agencies across states talking about how much cooperation that is occurring in order to keep things aligned between states.
Ms. Doctorey?
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Additionally, if I understand the question, part of what I understood the question to be was, scoping, right? Because there are many thousands of entities that collect Minnesotans' data and sell it, but not all of those entities. In fact, a relatively small subset in the hundreds, likely not the thousands or many thousands, would be data brokers. So understanding California law and what is being proposed here is that the scoping would be really to entities that don't have a direct relationship with the consumer, and the direct relationship defined here. So I think most often entities that are buying and then reselling that data would be the ones reflected in the data broker registry, rather than all entities that may directly collect consumer data and then sell it. My understanding of partially the thinking would be consumers have some awareness of who is collecting their data, but they might not always have easy access to or awareness of people down the chain. They have some tools to learn that information, but this would be another quite important tool.
Mr. Taylor, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to add to this, Chair. My question, my take on this is it does highlight the sort of the mismatch that we talked about earlier, in that the focus on whether or not there's a business model with a direct relationship to a consumer determines whether or not they are a data broker. Data brokers who do not have a direct relationship have to get the information from somewhere. Most often that is a first-party collection. I understand the amendment that was adopted today does make steps to broaden that scope and cover some of those activities where a first-party entity does collect it and sell it later on. Our concern remains that there seems to be an application of the concept of data broker to a whole host of companies who are working with data that is already exempt, but are not subject to an entity level exemption. So you're going to see many companies register who do not have obligations under the consumer data privacy statute to, for example, delete consumer information or provide it to them. And there are good reasons for this. You can think about it in the fraud context, where those companies do buy and in some cases sell consumer data with whom they do not have a direct relationship, to identify and help fight against financial fraud. Well, if you were to subject them to the disclosure obligations, that could provide a tool for fraudsters. And we certainly don't think that's the intent of the data privacy statute, but we certainly also don't want to see additions to it that would create confusion for consumers about who and what companies are doing at a given moment.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all of those answers. I think it's important that, we have this conversation about consumers which are people whose data is being sold, and people have no idea, right? There's this idea that consumers can sort of correct the data on the internet if they register themselves, and I think that's hilarious because I have no idea if there's incorrect data about me on the internet. I was just reviewing my data leaking report this morning that I get, and it's like everywhere all the time. Like, people have no idea what we're even talking about and how this is going to work and how this is going to help them. So I appreciate, Representative Elkins, your bill. I think that there is a huge amount of smoke and mirrors in this world, and people just want to let it go because it's too complicated and we need to get a handle on it. So I appreciate this. Happy to help in the future. This is a really concerning issue.
Representative Dodson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finke actually brought up a good point mentioning the registration process. The question I have for Representative Elkins is I noticed that the Attorney General has a right to actually charge whatever they choose to at will to cover expenses. Is that typically what's done in other states at this point, or what do you see in other states doing?
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dotseth. So the intention here is not to turn this into a profit center. It's to recover just enough money to pay for the registry itself. So it's intended to be a break even, and that's basically how the rates would be set.
And Representative Elkins, is that how they do it in California?
I believe so.
Ms. Doctorate.
Yes, Chair Giggle. I believe that is my understanding of how they set rates in California and other states, to the best of my knowledge at this time. And yes, our understanding of our obligations would be to set fees simply to cover the costs of maintaining a public-facing registry. My understanding of other states, that those fees typically range from a couple hundred dollars up to a few thousand, but not significant. I think our expectation is that ours would be somewhere in there.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, we do have a fiscal note where this will be estimated out that we expect to have by the time we get to judiciary.
Thank you. Representative Dotson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just hope as we move forward that we can get some guardrails on this as we move forward. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, again, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. But probably to the AG's office, because this is an industry that is definitely out of the state or off our shore, to say, I'd like to understand more about enforceability of anything we do in this space. Has it been, like, when you have to go after offshore companies, have you had success with that in the past with anything? I mean, that's what we're looking at, is a new world, and to get to Representative Finke's question, it's protection of the consumer, but do we have the means to protect our consumers on the great web or wherever the data is being circled? Do we have that? I mean, is it possible?
Ms. Doctory?
Chair Cagle, Representative, thank you for the question. It's really a civil procedure question, right, which I love as a lawyer. So we do have the authority to bring litigation, you know, against entities that are transacting business in Minnesota, and that have adequate contacts with Minnesota is really kind of how the law is set up. Certainly if they have a physical presence in Minnesota, that makes it easier. But there are, you know, many entities that are buying and selling Minnesotans' data. So there are, you are correct that there may be some that do not transact business in Minnesota at all. That is a possibility. But many entities that do transact business in Minnesotans' data are doing business in Minnesota, right? They have transactions and business happening here. And that kind of, just from a jurisdictional standpoint, does allow us to reach them and enforce laws against them, which is what we have done.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hewitt. Thank you. All right. Any other member? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple questions. Representative Elkins, I always appreciate the work that you do because you're a very thoughtful individual, and you and I have worked together on a number of things. Not quite sure why we're hearing this bill today specifically. I do understand that there's a fiscal note that this committee is not going to be able to have the privilege of taking a look at. We are in the financial part of the session, and it's disappointing that timing-wise, we're not going to see that. The other question that I guess I have is, what do you see as a path for this bill, given the fact that we're past policy deadlines, we don't have a fiscal target? I guess when they kind of look at the bigger picture of things, we don't have a Senate companion on this bill. Where are we heading from here, Representative Elkins?
Oh, thank you. Sir.
Representative
good
Elkins.
Questions, Chair O'Driscoll. Yeah, so Bonnie Westland in the Senate has agreed to be the Senate author. I got the jackets for this very late. It is a budget bill. It will need to land ultimately in state gov to be included in their budget package. And as you astutely observed, that we don't have any targets. So each financial proposal will be evaluated on its own merits. And we do expect that fiscal note to basically be neutral, because the objective is to have the registry pay for itself.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. And Representative Elkins, this is not specifically for you. This is just, deep thoughts by Jack Handy for those of you of a certain generation. More than
Sam
I thought this morning. That makes me feel good.
Chair O'Driscoll, I'm sure Sam does not know that one.
I'm just trying to figure out where we end up going with this. If we were going to have targets at this point, I think we would have had them. We have six meetings left until the second deadline. Yeah. And so I'm just wondering why we're, how this is all going to pull together. And it's not necessarily just this particular bill, but others that may be coming forward as well. So yeah. There may be not a specific answer to that, but I think that question needs to be raised at this point in the process as to no targets, no money, nothing in the possession of this committee in the way of spending, and yet we're talking about spending and trying to move bills along. So thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Elkins, for your work.
Yeah, thank you. So,
thank
Madam
you, Chair O'Driscoll. Yeah. Representative Elkins.
I listened to Chair Torkelson on Almanac a couple of weeks ago talking about how we aren't going to have targets, and there is still a projected budget surplus by the end of this session, this biennium. And that when things get to Ways and Means, there'll be a negotiation there. But my strategy here is to get this into the hands of its budget committee, which would be state government, so that it could be considered within their whatever they send to Ways and Means towards at the end of the session.
Any follow-up? Thank you, Representative Elkins and Chair O'Driscoll. I think one of the main things that the reason that we're having these hearings is that we do want to make sure that we're hearing the provisions of the bills that relate to our committee, so that they can move ahead within the fiscal committee that they do impact. And even though we don't have targets, I think we're still really eager to get work done in these next few weeks, and so want to give us as many opportunities to get good work done for the people of Minnesota. And so, we're still fighting to get good policy across the finish line. And so that's just kind of some of my thoughts with those bills. And so I appreciate everybody showing up today. I know it's not great getting up at 8:15, but I think these are important issues to the folks in Minnesota. So any final thoughts, Representative Elkins?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the bill amends Chapter 325M, which is a consumer protection law, which is why we're here. And I like to start my bills here when I can, because this is a good audience. But to Representative Finke's concern earlier, under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, you have similar sorts of rights. You have the right to see your data, to have it corrected, and have your credit score recalculated if you find an error in the data. And I have done that and got an increase in my credit score as a result. One of the credit bureaus had not reflected the payoff of a home improvement loan, and once they corrected the data, I got a better credit score. So there are ways to accomplish this, and in fact, I have a provision like that in the Act.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And so I will move that House File 4203, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 All those opposed? Nay.
No.
Division.
All right.
All those in favor, please raise your hands. All those opposed? There being there being 10 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we'll go to Representative Godfrey's bill and just do a quick juggle real quick since he's in the room. Welcome to the committee, Representative Godfrey. I will move that House file. Let me 3698 be moved to the general register.
Madam Chair, actually, that I believe it needs to go to rules first.
Rules will call it in. It always gets pulled in after deadline.
Thank you for correcting me.
So thank you, Representative Godfrey. And so welcome to the committee. If you, I understand you have an author's amendment, an A2. I will move the adoption of the A2 author's amendment to get the would you like to explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. So the A2 amendment kind of is the result of a successful committee bipartisan committee process. So I'll address the smaller part of it on line 1.4 of the A2. That kind of strikes newspapers from being operationally included within this bill. The reason for this is because we have found throughout the committee process that there is actually the newspapers and our publicly funded libraries are not in an adverse relationship as far as the contracts that newspapers put upon our publicly funded libraries. And so we didn't want them catching strays, so to speak, in this legislation. So that's that part of this this amendment. And then the larger part of the amendment, if you look at the online of the underlying bill, line 2.19, we originally defined publisher, but throughout the committee process, we realized, well, publishers certainly do engage in these practices of putting our publicly funded libraries into some onerous contracts. They are not the only entities to do so. There are often third-party intermediaries and vendors that do the same thing, acting as middlemen and inflating the cost of these contracts that we have with them as part of our publicly funded libraries. And so we wanted to make sure that the bill language was inclusive of those just conceptually. So the operational definition remains the same. The integrity is intact. But we wanted to make sure as we continue discussions about this bill and if it becomes statute with the public, so the public has a better understanding just at a higher level of what the bill is actually trying to accomplish. So that is why we are making these, are hoping to make these amendments.
Thank you. All right. I will move the A2 amendment to House File 3698. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Godfrey, to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 3698 is a bill that seeks to address a problem wherein publicly funded libraries are being price gouged by the vendors of ebooks and audiobooks. These vendors are charging more for one loanable ebook for fewer uses than a typical physical copy would be used. And this bill fixes this by setting common sense parameters around the contracts that public libraries can enter while using taxpayer dollars. So this legislation will put public dollars to better use, alleviate pressure on county and school district budgets, and, you know, really make authors' works more available to readers through one of the biggest discovery channels in the country, that being public libraries. And to, you know, underscore this point, you have some wonderful, wonderful packets of testimony here. Please take a look at the letter of support for this bill written by Minnesota author William Kent Krueger. And now, in order to speak more to the specifics of this situation that we're attempting to solve, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Sarah Hawkins, my testifier.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hawkins. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Hawkins. I am the Assistant Director at Anoka County Library and the Legislative Chair of the Minnesota Library Association. House File 3698 addresses a growing imbalance in the digital book marketplace, one that affects taxpayers, schools, and libraries, and Minnesota's overall information economy. Today, libraries routinely pay 3 to 5 times more than consumers for ebooks, and the licenses we buy expire after 2 years or 26 checkouts. We're not purchasing lasting community assets. We're paying for short-term rentals repeatedly. House File 3698 uses contract law, defining the terms under which publicly funded libraries may enter digital licensing agreements. It restores transparency and fairness in the marketplace while fully protecting copyright holders' rights. Nothing in this bill changes copyright, royalties, or authors' control of their work. Right now, libraries cannot negotiate or comparison shop, the tools that normally help markets function efficiently. Vendor non-disclosure agreements prevent even basic transparency about pricing or terms. This is a rare area of public procurement where government agencies are asked to sign contracts they cannot discuss. House File 3698 restores normal commercial expectations. Print books operate in a normal competitive market. Libraries buy once and own the item for as long as we want, often 70 or more checkouts and often 10 years or more. Digital content operates under restrictive, non-negotiable licenses. Prices can change at any time, and inflated library pricing does not increase author royalties. Most of that revenue goes to the intermediaries. House File 3698 simply ensures reasonable contract terms for public purchasers while keeping copyright protections fully intact. These restrictions directly impact access, especially for students, patrons with disabilities, and communities that rely heavily on shared resources. In the Twin Cities, our consortial digital collection circulated 13.98 million digital items in 2025, the highest circulating consortium in the world. And even with that scale, Metro Libraries spent $6.5 million on digital content last year, yet our unmet demand still exceeded $21 million. Rebuying the same titles year after year weakens the value of taxpayer dollars and undermines Minnesota Libraries' role in the reading ecosystem. For just one popular author in 2025, Metro Libraries purchased 835 licenses at a cost of $55,711. And even then, more than 2,400 readers were still waiting for those titles. Every one of those licenses expires and must be repurchased next year. Only a small portion reaches the author. The rest reinforces an inflated pricing structure. Fair terms actually support authors by increasing discovery and readership without touching copyright. Libraries drive discovery, and discovery drives sales. Fair pricing expands readership, strengthens Minnesota's book economy, and supports creators. House File 3698 respects creators' rights while ensuring that the public sector can function in a sustainable, transparent marketplace. In other forms of public digital procurement, software, databases, media, agencies receive predictable pricing, transparent terms, and contracts they can evaluate. Ebook licensing is a lone outlier. House File 3698 brings this sector back into alignment with standard public sector contracting practices. Connecticut used contract law to ensure libraries can only enter agreements with fair, transparent terms. Their law does not regulate copyright or private sector pricing outside the library market, and Minnesota's bill follows the same balanced, legally sound approach. House File 3698 protects taxpayer dollars, restores local control, supports libraries, and ensures sustainable digital access. It strengthens Minnesota's reading ecosystem while preserving all copyright protections and improving how this commercial market functions. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We also have Justin Emmerich. If you could please come to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
All right, Chair Cagle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Emmerich with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of our client, the Association of American Publishers. We respectfully stand in opposition to House File 3698. Digital access has expanded how people read and listen to books. In addition to print books, publishers now offer the latest best-selling novels to libraries in digital format. More patrons than ever before can access for free, at the push of a button, a record number of award-winning and best-selling literary works that they might otherwise have purchased from booksellers, including new releases. If I can draw your attention to member packets, also standing in opposition to this legislation are over 17,000 authors and creators from the Authors Guild, over 4,000 publishers from the Independent Book Publishers Association and the News Media Alliance. This legislation, if passed, would reduce access, undermine the rights of authors and publishers, and threaten the viability of other book markets. This legislation attempts to take away these rights from authors, publishers, and creators, enabling the government to make decisions about creators' intellectual property instead of the creators themselves. The likely impact of this legislation is it will reduce rather than expand access to digital library materials in Minnesota. When publishers cannot meet the restrictive demands in this legislation, libraries may very well lose access to new releases, experience higher costs, or be prohibited by the state from licensing ebooks and audiobooks altogether. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. We have Rick Heller on the list of testifiers, but I do not see him.
He's virtual.
Mr. Heller, if you'd like to proceed. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
He's muted.
You're muted, sir.
Now he is.
Go ahead.
He's unmuted.
We cannot hear you. Can you hear us? Give me a thumbs up if you can. All right. Mr. Heller, we're having some communication issues. Doesn't look like you can hear us. If you want, we can take some member questions and then see if we can get the audio figured out.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Oh, hi. It must be some technical difficulties with this headphones and stuff. So you can hear me. So anyhow, that's what matters. Anyways, my name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional People with Print Disabilities. You'll find a bill, a couple bills, 3328 brings awareness to the print disability. Anyhow, I come to testify about the bill. Some vagueness perhaps with the other two testifiers. I could bring you up to snuff if discretion of the chair. I did ask your staff to post a document that's mandated to the legislature on October 14th. 2024 called Students Who Are Blind and Vision Impaired, but they didn't post it. Anyways, on page 64 specifically, it mentions, I'm gonna just go to the last paragraph on the top of the page. The header is Accessible Education Materials, State Service for the Blind Interagency Agreement. So I'm gonna start with the very last, that's a long sentence, isn't it? It's a, well, I guess I have the interagency agreement between MDE, and that's Minnesota Department of Education, I think State Service of the Blind, SSB supports individual school districts with the provision of accessible education materials, EAM, and formats of Braille and audio materials. Such schools in Minnesota who agree to participate in the special education assurances are provided with certain Braille and audio materials at no cost. So here we're talking about a cost. IEPs do not mention consider print disability or twice exceptional, currently both undefined in education law. It's my understanding the Library Association on slide 4 specifically mentions IEPs, individual education plans, and 504 plans. So anyhow, I'm not quite sure, I don't know if you know, anybody's aware of this, but when Congress approved the Global Treaty in 2018 for the Book Ban for the Blind and Print Disabled, shared digital materials across the continents. Library of Congress Services decided next year in 2019 to merge blind and print disability and call them eligible individuals. Secondly, they changed the scope. Who can authenticate or provide, sign off for those services? Over 12. And one of them, one of the professions was the librarians in 1931 who came up with the word print disability. One other thing too about this copyright thing, the copyright law was relaxed for those specific people, but I'm not quite sure when the Librarian Association which have yet to recognize on their line that I'm aware of that they can authenticate a print disability by signing off on it, this is relevant. I see the other one, that copyright law person, Pacific Independent Book Publishers document, including the PowerPoint for Librarian Association, not totally digitally accessible. I'd ask that they correct that, resend it. I'm also asking that you would post page 64 of this mandated document to the legislature. So the question comes down to this. How many people will get free services on audio and digital books? And is it really that we can read, or is it that we can understand information effectively? Seeing and hearing is relevant to universal design access. Just like one person in the room did sign on to a bill that required the legislature to be digitally accessible. I believe it was House File 1962 on digital accessibility from the legislature.
Thank you. Mr. Hill, can I ask you to wrap up here shortly?
Yeah, so the question comes down to, do we want to bring more awareness to this regarding print disability? And do you need to do more research as far as with the Minnesota Library Association, and as far as they can already enroll these kids for free and not have to pay these exorbitant costs that are being provided by the book publishers. So I'm trying to provide more information. I'm always available to anyone more interested in this, and I'm open to questions. But to the chair, I wonder if any of the people that testify would yield to a question.
Well, we're going to move to member discussion. Thank you very much, Mr. Heller. We do appreciate it.
If I may just say one thing, and I'm going to turn it off here. I would ask that one of the people could ask that question if they choose to. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak at your committee. Commerce Committee.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. Is there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Godfrey, for bringing the bill forward. So a couple of questions, and if the testifiers could stand up. But first of all, to nonpartisan staff, as I look at lines 3.14 and on, and I look at 3.119, 3.21, everything in here restricts or prohibits the library's actions. Is that correct?
Ms. Pompu?
Chair and members, one moment, I'm pulling up the bill. Could you repeat the question, Representative Kreisha?
Yeah.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to nonpartisan staff, so as I look through this, I'm looking at what the bill actually does, and I get through the definitions and all that, and when the enactment, but then we get to subdivision 3.14, where we get where the teeth of the bill really is. And as I read that through it, what we're really doing is restricting what a library can do as far as entering into agreements. Is that correct?
Ms. Kompu?
Chair and members, correct.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the testifiers, I'll start with the libraries. You're asking us to give you a bill that restricts what you can do. Is that correct?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, yes, that's correct.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so to the publisher, nothing in this bill changes anything you can or will do in the future. Is that correct? You're just going to respond to what the publishers are now restricted, or the libraries are restricted to do.
Mr. Emmerich.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, that's correct. I think these are all things the libraries can already choose to do. But yes, the state would be putting these restrictions in place. We would be responding to those restrictions.
Representative Kreisha.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Godfrey, you're putting a bill in front of us that the libraries could already do this today, right? They could choose not to get into this. We're now just codifying that they are restricted and prohibited from that. Is that correct? That's what you're asking with this bill.
Representative Godfrey.
Close, yeah. So the way that I look at this is that if you look at it from a business perspective, right, And if you think of our publicly funded libraries as procurement agents, so to speak, if we were in a business, and we're working with a bunch of middlemen that are in the way of a particular product and inflating prices and stuff, you ask your procurement agents to get a better contract. And that's essentially what we are doing, is we're trying to make sure that our publicly funded libraries are able to get a better contract with our taxpayer dollars. Now, if you look at that particular, those lines that you see, you know, there's restrictions around the terms of a contract, but there's no restrictions around the price of a particular contract. And so what I would say is that there's likely a scenario wherein, if this law becomes statute, that the publishers, the third-party entities, could increase the prices of their contracts as a logical, rational response to this legislation. And I think that is something that the, you know, we are willing, if so long as the other terms of the contract, we actually think is a better deal for the taxpayer in the long run. And so that is essentially what we're trying to do, is making sure that we are using taxpayer dollars to the best of our ability.
Representative Krusha.
Madam Chair, so Representative Godfrey, you said close. You're either restricting or you're not restricting. Which is it?
Well, we are restricting, Godfrey. But it is because we are trying to seek a better deal with the taxpayers, yes.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I just have a couple more.
Representative Krusha.
So to the library, I'm a big proponent of the libraries. I support what you do. But you are asking me to vote for essentially a book banning provision that you could do on your own because you don't like, and I get it, the terms of these, you've used words like inflated and all that. Those are arbitrary words. We don't know that. We don't know the you know, the publishers are putting pricing together in models, and I understand people think, we always think things are expensive, but the writers have written this. They're obligated to get paid for their creativity and their work. So I get it. You're trying to force negotiation. You're trying to do it at the table. When the real negotiation needs to happen between these two parties and the people that are going to borrow those books. Is there anything, this will be my final question, is there anything in statute today that prevents the libraries from doing this right now? Not entering into agreements with publishers that they find to be cost prohibitive. Is there anything in statute that prevents that action from happening today?
Thank you, Representative Krusha. And I think there's a big difference between...
Madam Chair, I'm asking the question. I'm not looking for clarification.
I understand, but you made a reference to banning books, and that's against the first...
I'm addressing to the chair. Can we please follow the protocols?
So there's a big difference between infringing on people's First Amendment rights and negotiating contracts. So I think that was a very, that wasn't a very good analogy. And I think to
Madam
what
Chair,
we're trying to.
Madam Chair, with all due respect,
Mr.
I'm simply asking
Representative Krusha, I'm the chair of this committee.
You
and
are,
I
and
would
I'm going through the chair. Representative Watkins of Toon and Companies, if you guys want to run this, I'll go ahead.
I didn't.
I'm just trying to get through a bill that's presented in front of me. These are fair questions. I'm not trying to
pin. They are fair questions, and I have an ability to make a comment before I go to Representative Godfrey. So I would really
Madam
appreciate
Chair, point of parliamentary inquiry.
Go ahead.
Are our questions directed through the chair or to the chair?
They are through the chair, and as chair, I can make comments.
Okay, very good. So let's go ahead and set this up combatively. Go ahead and make your comments, and then I'm going to run this out a long time.
Well, we can see who is. All right, Representative Godfrey. I do agree that there's a big difference between saying book banning and restricting contracts. That was the point I was trying to make. Representative Godfrey, would you like to answer Representative Krusha's question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Krusha, for the question. I would agree that there is a very multiple steps between what we are trying to do and in trying to get good contracts and making sure that we're using taxpayer dollars responsibly and banning books. That those are very, very different things. To your point, there is nothing in statute right now that is prohibiting the libraries from doing this right now. What the issue is market power. So as we're talking about the way that our economy functions, I believe there's really five big players that have consolidated market power, monopolization over this industry, that are controlling the entire market. And so the reason why individual libraries practically can't do what you're suggesting is because they don't have the market power to do so. And the reason why that we are trying to do this as a state to have a better public procurement process is so that we as a state can leverage our market power as a state to be able to do that for or help libraries coalesce and do that together. Now, that is a very, very big distinction. You'll notice that there is a provision in here that says that this law does not go into effect until there is a population of 7 million outside of Minnesota that also adopts this law. The reason why we specifically put that provision in there is because we have done the economic analysis that is included in the library ebook group, a provision that you see in the testimony packet that recognizes that even a single state of a smaller population may be disaffected if this were to go into law individually in one state. And so that's why that compact is there with other states, such that there is the market power that that publishers and the vendors that they work with to do this won't just pull out of these states. So to answer your question, there's nothing in statute that prevents this from happening. But really what this bill is about is trying to leverage the market power that we as a state and other states have to make sure that our collective taxpayer dollars are being put to the best use. And that's what this is about. It's not about banning books. It is about making sure that we are leveraging our market power as a state, as a publicly funded entity, for these publicly funded entities, rather, to make sure that we can use those taxpayer dollars as best as we can. Excuse me. Apologies for that. And that's what this bill is trying to do. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fatisa-Witsoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gottfried, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I'm a co-author. I think, you know, I'm an avid reader, huge supporter of our library system. For those who are watching today and for those on the committee who may not be utilizing the amazing services that our libraries provide, the Twin Cities Metro e-libraries available to all of us with a library card, the app that allows us to borrow e-books, audiobooks, the wait lists are very long. And I think in part of the opening testimony, someone had made mention to the fact that libraries are paying either every 2 year period or on a 26 checkout. And I just find that fascinating. I've got 13 books on hold right now out of the 15 books that I'm able to put on hold. And the last one that's going to take me the longest to get, I'm 377th in line. So when I'm doing just that calculation, right, 377 divided by 26, that means that the library is paying for that book 14 times before I'm able to read it. And they're paying an average of 3 to 5 times more than an individual would to purchase an ebook on Audible or another similar service. It is fascinating to me the direction that this debate is going, in which our colleagues on the other side of the aisle seem to want taxpayers to spend 3 to 5 times more per book and have to pay multiple times for material that, you know, libraries should have access to. We're paying, this is our money. So again, if you're not using these services, go get yourself a library card for free and read. Madam Chair, I would request a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Cortez-Witsoon. Roll call will be taken. Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for those comments, Representative Cortez-Witsoon. Yeah, I think there's an issue with the display of the presentation on those screens. So I just ask that for this little presentation packet here to go to page 2, which really highlights the core problem that we're trying to address. And if you look at that little graph, this uses the most conservative estimate that we can, in that, you know, if a physical copy of or a personal retail license of an ebook is $15, and then a library price that they are charged is $45. Again, that is the lowest end of that. So the most conservative estimate that we could do. Typically, if you own a book, an ebook, your own book, you can listen to it, you can read it in perpetuity. And again, these contracts, three times more, you only get 26 checkouts of those. And then let's compare it to a physical book. You know, we're talking about the same sort of material that begins with once upon a time, and at the end of the book says the end. Same material, same stuff that appears there. You know, let's say that a book, it's an expensive paper copy book. It's $20. That's about the price of a pretty high end book right now for a paper copy. If a library to buy that, they could circulate that for 10 plus years. They buy that for $20 as opposed to the ebook version of that. Again, the exact same material, the exact same story that is being told, the exact same material being conveyed. That's going to cost them $45. And they can only check that out 26 times. And you can think about some of the really, really popular publications that we have, the Harry Potters of the world or whatever the kids are reading nowadays.
Project Hail Mary.
Right, exactly. And so you can see how that would take up an immense amount of a library's budget and prevent access to these particular things and just waste taxpayer dollars. And again, I do want to just get back to that. This is about responsibility with our taxpayer dollars, and that is the problem that we're trying to solve. So thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to kind of expand upon the problem that Representative Katiza Watum brought up.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
I have a comment and then a question. Actually, I might reverse it. I'm going to ask a question first, and it's for the libraries. Can I ask about the escalating cost of this on library budgets, kind of overall, and how this is affecting library operations in other sectors because you're spending more money here?
Ms. Hawkins?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. It is e-content is increasingly taking up more and more of our collections budgets. For me, for example, in Anoka County, we're currently at about 50% on what we're spending on physical materials versus digital materials, and yet physical circulation is not decreasing. Physical circulation is staying the same. Digital circulation is what is increasing. We're spending more of our budget on digital. Digital is currently only about 30% of our circulation, yet we're spending upwards of 50% on our collection budget on digital. At the same time, you know, physical circulation is staying the same. So we're having less money to put towards our physical collection while that circulation is staying the same.
Representative Smith?
That actually, thank you, Chair. That brought up a second question. Sorry if you can bear with me, Madam Chair. Could I also ask, I would imagine digital distribution is especially helpful, I'm from Greater Minnesota, in communities where the population is more spread out. Is there data that reflects that from your association?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that data specifically right now. I will say that one of the things that is interesting about digital content and is that it's actually posing a problem for us is when in Minnesota, we have such a strong sharing network of our physical collection. You can live in, you know, International Falls, or you can live in Austin, and the item can travel through statewide delivery from one to the other. So we're able to share our physical collection and be much more physically responsible with that content. That is not currently true of our digital content. We don't have the ability to share our digital content based on our contracts. So that's one of the other things that this bill is trying to solve so that we can share our digital content and our digital content can be much more equitable statewide as well.
Representative Smith?
As someone who's currently waiting on several ILL books, I appreciate that focus. Maybe just finish with a comment. I am a book person. My wife and I own a bookstore. Before that, my wife worked for our local library. I've heard from my local library and the city about this bill and how important it is to their budget, but more important to the patrons of the library. I'm very excited about this bill. Representative Gottfried, I've already asked to be added as a co-author while you're presenting. Hopefully you will accept me. I think also, since we're in the Commerce Committee, it's worth zooming out and talking again about what we've talked about a lot, which is the digital economy that is new. New things are popping up in this digital economy, and so much of the promise of the internet was to simplify people's lives. And in many ways, digital content can. We just talked about someone who's not living close to a population center could have access to an e-book through the St. Paul Library when they're living in International Falls. But what we see increasingly with us not being proactive, us as public servants who are serving the needs of the people of Minnesota, not putting in safeguards, is people will come in and take advantage of this new economy. If you look at these charts, it's not the library patrons who are being served most by this. It's not even the authors and the artists who are being served by this. It's third-party vendors or publishers who own the rights that are making the most money off of this, just like we see large tech companies making all kinds of money. We just talked about them making money off of our data when we were just trying to communicate with friends online or buy something online. And so this is a small part of a much larger whole that I think is really important. So thank you for bringing this bill. I'm happy to support it.
Thank you. Representative Cha.
Yeah, I just have a question for clarification. If I buy a digital book, can I lend it to a friend? And can I share that?
Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cha. I am actually going to defer to my testifier here on that question.
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Representative. In some cases, you can lend a digital book to a patron, or to, sorry, not to a patron, to someone in your life, and you then don't have access to it while you are lending it, and then it comes back to your digital shelf. In some vendors and in some cases, that is possible, not in all. Of course, that's up to the consumer and their relationship with the vendor.
Representative Chaff.
So legally, as a private citizen, I can have a collection of 1,000 books and decide to lend it to my so-called community, right? Can I do that legally?
I don't know if Ms. Hawkins would be the person to say that, to give you legal advice. but I don't know how many law books she's read in there. But Representative Godfrey or Ms. Hawkins, or maybe the publishers would care to answer?
You know, for clarification purposes, I'm not a lawyer. I would go to Representative Cha's library if he had one, but, you know, most of the time, when you purchase a digital license, it's for single use. And so the licenses that are purchased by the libraries are for multi-use. And so I don't know. In some cases, maybe I'm going to defer to the libraries for what their comment was on it. But most cases, you're buying a single-use license. And so I don't know if your aspirations of building your own library are quite well thought out yet.
Representative.
Thank you.
Depends how many passwords you share with your friends, right? I had a question to Mr. Emmerich. Does it cost more to publish a book or an e-book?
You know, I don't have that exact information, and you're comparing two different products as well, too, because when you're looking at an e-book or an audiobook, there's additional costs that go into there as well. You're also worried a lot more about piracy as well. You know, you put something online, someone can download it, and there's software and other apps that, you know, people are going to take and put those online. If you look for different books online on Amazon, you can find pirated copies of that, right? And so that is a cost. So there's going to be costs for both. There's going to be the physical cost of the physical book. But then with digital books, too, you know, when you're looking at, you know, 400 copies that are going to have 16 licenses, you're getting a perfect book each time you have that, right? So there is benefit to those licenses as well. I can tell you, if you've been someone who's gone to the library, I'm an avid reader, and I get a physical book and I'm the 30th person to check out that book, that is not a perfect copy, right? You are missing maybe pages. You might have to Google and figure out, you know, if someone ripped out a page. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Justin, for that. And, you know, I don't think the piracy thing is the problem that we're trying to solve right here. But if you want to collaborate on an anti-piracy bill, you know, happy to do that in a future session. So.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is one of the reasons I just absolutely love this place. First of all, you can't pass a bill to the General Register after deadline. So that motion is out of order. And I've never seen in all my years here, and it's a disturbing trend, that we are making libraries partisan. In 34 years, I've never seen a roll call asked for a library bill. This is absurd. You know, we have deadlines for a reason. This is strictly a political vote. I can't wait to vote no for this because I'm going to tell my libraries that they're being used as political pawns. They're being used as political pawns. And the rules are being broken. This is an illegitimate meeting. Deadlines are there for a reason. They're called deadlines. If they don't make it, they're dead. That's the way it works around here. So I'm going to be sending an email out to all my librarians saying you have been used as political pawns. I apologize for that. Roll calls on library bills. Oh, my. How times have changed. But, you know, it's always something different. That's why I just love this place so much.
Representative Finke.
I would like to talk about the bill. All this other stuff doesn't matter.
Madam Chair, I was talking about the bill.
I'm going to continue to talk about the
bill. Thank you, Representative Finke, being that you have the floor.
Yeah. I just wanted to say it seems to me to be that there is an idea here that books won't end up in libraries if we pass this bill. That seems to be the implied repercussion that we're going to see, and I think that's a bluff. I think that we shouldn't take it. I'm an author. My book is available in bookstores and in libraries. About 5% of authors make their living writing books. People write books because they want audiences to read them. And authors, the idea that authors would support not having their books available to the public through libraries is not something that I think we should worry about. We want our books read more than we want publishers to have good contracts. So I appreciate this bill. I think that the point of art is to get it in the hands of people. So thank you for your work. I also love public libraries. Can't wait to vote for the bill, I guess.
Thank you. Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me first start off by saying it's the bill that we're debating, not the personalities. And if I triggered that in the chair, that was not my intention. My questions were to the bill author. Representative Godfrey, you and I haven't talked about this bill. I have no ear on you or anything personal. Had I been allowed to continue, which thank you for allowing me to do that, because I'm about to turn my real ear on the publisher. I'm a big library proponent. I have supported the funding. I've moved it through education finance. I have found lots of ways for libraries. My point, Representative Godfrey, is by putting this bill in place, we restrict only the libraries at this point, which means their access will be restricted. You've got charters and schools in here as well, which becomes a mandate. Those are things we need to work out, because until we get to the root of this problem, which is accessibility that the publisher controls at this point, we're going to set up this very difficult situation. What I would say to the publisher is you have to work with these institutions. You have the most knowledge, you have the most leverage, you have the most abilities to get this to our libraries and get this to people and patrons who may not have the same economic resources of just going to an Amazon and so forth. If you do not, Amazon and so forth are going to take over this market. Audible already gives you free credits like crazy. So I am now in a position where I am voting no, because we have made this ridiculously partisan when we didn't have to, and we could have put this back on the table. I understand what you're trying to do. You're forcing your hand in negotiation. But we've now put the publishers against the local libraries and schools, and I think that's a bad place to be at this table. What I would hope is, and I'm going to vote no on this, because, again, we're restricting everything. We're taking the tools away from the libraries, and we're doing nothing to the publishers except allowing them to work with 48 other states. One or two state compacts may happen here, but they're just going elsewhere. Representative Godfrey, I believe you've addressed the problem. I believe it's identified. I just believe that this is not the right approach, because there are other more effective levers that we could be doing. And so that's my comments. And thank you for allowing me to close with that.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Thank you, Chair.
I just want to say thank you for this. As a little girl who grew up in poverty, having access to books, my only option was at the library. And so my mom and my brothers and I spent a lot of time at libraries, and so I have very fond memories of being there. And a lot of my work here at the Capitol has made sure to never forget where I came from and that those voices are important. And so I recognize and just want to put on the record that obviously saving you money on these sorts of things won't just save you money on e-books. It saves you money on a place where families can spend time together affordably. It helps you save money on providing a space for sometimes family visits for parents who are under supervised custody. It provides you the opportunity to continue to provide those conference rooms where people meet with their caseworkers, where people talk about the disability services that they're not able to access. The library is a place where my community finds community with each other. It's a place where people learn English. It's a place where people practice their for their driver's test. The library in my community has been critical. And these are libraries in Dakota County that, again, I've gone to my entire life. And so I hope that what you're trying to do here isn't just seen as something about books. I'm sad to hear some of the comments from the other side of the aisle here today, knowing that I probably wouldn't be who I am. My brothers would not be the soldiers they are without access to as much education as we could reach at the library. It was also a place where we had our Cub Scout meetings. It's where we had Pinewood Derby races, where Girl Scouts sold cookies and learned about what badges they could get. And so I just want to remind us that libraries are not just places where books are purchased and bought and used. Or not returned as they should be sometimes. But I remember feeling such a sense of responsibility when I had my first library card. And so that empowerment that we give young people, the opportunities to volunteer and to see maybe I want to work in a library or something like that as a little girl. So I thank you for bringing this, and I hope we can remember that libraries are critical aspects for our entire community. I also, just to be sure I'm clear about the applicability of the bill, we actually aren't doing anything today, correct? This actually just gives an opportunity for if other states do this, that then this would kick in. And so we're actually just creating a conversation and an opportunity for libraries to cut what sounds like one of your biggest costs, maybe aside from operations or wages or staff time, and that you're working on trying to find a path forward soon, maybe in the coming years, but not today. And so I, for the record, just want to be really clear that subdivision 2 of this bill does pretty clearly talk about when this would go into effect, and it is not immediate. And so I think it is important to continue this conversation, especially for folks who support libraries, because I know how strapped you are. And so thank you for being here today and for raising the conversation, and I hope we can center ourselves back on how important libraries are to all of our communities across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I would just like to ask you to review a couple of things for us, because we had a lot of discussion on this. I know we have another bill that's coming up, and so I'm hoping that our discussion on this bill comes to an end soon. Is there a fiscal note on this?
Representative Godfrey.
There is not, no.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your bill, can you just review, we've talked a lot about public libraries, county libraries, city libraries. Does your bill also cover public school libraries? Does it cover private schools, private colleges, private universities, private parochial schools, charter schools, other schools that forms of learning? Are they just going to be left on the curb and not being able to participate in what you're talking about, and that group would be segregated?
Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair O'Driscoll, for the question. So this bill is covers publicly funded libraries as defined in the bill as libraries that receive 50% of their funding or more from public sources, so taxpayer dollars. And the reason why it's limited to those entities is because that's where we have jurisdiction. You know, we've talked about some other levers that could potentially be used to accomplish the same result. Those have been tried other places, but directly, you know, regulating contracts for publishers is not something that I'm interested in doing. That is an infringement on their rights. But we have a right to set the contracts that we use taxpayer dollars for. So in this, that regard, to answer your question directly, again, any entity that receives 50% or more of its funding from public sources, taxpayer dollars, that is who is affected by this bill.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could ask Ms. Hawkins a question as well. If I remember correctly from testimony today, about 30% of book distribution right now is in an e-format. Do I remember that correctly?
Ms. Hawkins?
That's correct. In my specific Anoka County Library situation, correct.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hawkins, yes. So in that 30%, what percentage or portion of those are ebooks that have the actual physical words on a mobile device for people to read versus the traditional book on tape?
Ms. Hawkins?
Or the audio version?
That would be, for us, it's roughly 40% is ebook books that you're reading on a screen versus the digital file audiobook that you're listening to is 60% of our digital circulation. And that number, the audiobook number, is increasing as the ebook number stays about the same, increases slightly. But the audiobook listening is what's really skyrocketing at this point for our users.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of additional follow-up questions for Ms. Hawkins. So to Representative Katizu Watun's testimony or her inquiry, her comments today about she's 300 and something on a list for an ebook to wait, and she mentioned how many times that book had to be renewed before it gets to her. Are you meeting the consumer and public needs by buying hard copy books to make those available for those titles so that, number one, it can save you money, number two, you can amortize and leverage that more often and for a longer period of time for more users in the library system? Maybe you can comment on that for the committee's benefit.
Ms. Hawkins?
Correct. I can speak only to those statistics, again, for my specific Anoka County Library situation. But, yeah, we actually purchase our physical collection at a rate of 5-1. Once there's 5 people waiting for a title, we're purchasing an additional copy every single time. 5 people waiting, a new copy. 5 people waiting, new copy. For digital, it's often 15 people or more that we have to wait until we can buy another copy.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, this is my final comment on the topic today. I am concerned, not necessarily with the objective of what we're looking at here. I understand that, but what I'm concerned about is if we go back and Representative Kreisha, who's the co-chair of the Education Finance and Finance Committee for Education, he knows probably better than anyone at this table, unless you're in the education realm, how students are falling behind in reading right now as it is. COVID didn't really do us a lot of benefit and a lot of favors at this point. And so to hear the number of books that are purchased in electronic form and the audio versus the actual physical reading part, we're going to create another generation of non-readers or inability to read or various types of illiteracy. And I think that leaning and leveraging the hard copy titles is not only more cost effective, I think it's also very helpful for getting and bridging that gap for reading for folks versus the audio where you're engaging people in more of the lifelong skills and lifelong need, because you can always read to find out the answer to a question, but if you're not a functional reader, you're very disadvantaged in this society. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Representative Katizu Watun had a quick,
super quick, thank you. I actually think that sometimes the paper books are easier to find. Representative O'Driscoll, but just since you had mentioned that, I went in and I looked just where it would compare, and there's actually 383 people waiting for the new adult paper copy of this book, and currently the ebook, there's 771 people waiting. I'm just further up on the list, so. I've read 20 books already this year. I wouldn't have been able to do that without our public libraries. There are so many people who don't have expendable income, and the fact that taxpayers are already contributing to this and it's a service that we're already paying for, I think it really makes sense for us to support libraries in getting enough market support to make some of these changes. So I appreciate the discussion today, and thank you, Representative, for bringing the bill forward.
I want to say that I'm really grateful for this as well. We can see that this has already passed two committees in the House, so it's a bipartisan bill. I am a sucker and got pressured into hearing this by a constituent, and I'm sure you know her, Ms. Hawkins, Stacy. And so this is not for partisan reason because it's already a bipartisan bill. This is because our constituents and our libraries put the pressure on. And that's what we're supposed to react to, correct, is the pressure of our constituents and the pressure of the public organizations around us. And so my intent was not to make this a political bill. In fact, I thought it would be a good bipartisan vote that we could move forward on, but I'm disappointed that that's not going to be the case. You know, Melissa told me one thing, that nothing's ever dead until the gavel drops on sine die. And so, you know, we're here to get the work done. And there's always exceptions to the rules, which is why we have a rules committee. And so I'm very actually surprised at the turn that this took. And I do want to clarify the motion. My understanding is that we refer to the GR and then it automatically gets pulled into rules. Is that correct, Ms. Pompeo? Or do I need to make the motion to rules?
Chair and members, I'm not sure of the appropriate motion here.
Okay. So either way, it will be pulled into rules. If you would like me, Chair Davids, I can make the motion to rules if you'd like.
No, I guess that really doesn't matter. But as far as being bipartisan, what made it political in my mind was a roll call on a library bill. I've never seen that before. So all the good reasons you give really don't matter because we're past the deadlines. We're past the deadlines. Are we going to honor the rules and the deadlines or not? So it's not going anywhere, so just send it where you want.
Well, I think we are honoring the rules by sending it to rules, and everything we do has to have bipartisan support. So if it moves on in rules, it will have bipartisan support. Representative Godfrey, any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this part of this discussion. Yeah, this was more partisan than I thought it was going to be, and which did surprise me. There are GOP authors to this bill. I will make a note that my GOP author that sits on this committee left this committee with a very dour look on his face as this bill was called up. So I'm not here to impugn motives or anything, but that did happen for the public's knowledge. We are really trying to address a problem that we are seeing where there is great demand for these particular materials, and there is, because of that great demand for these materials, there's a lot of price gouging going on because of these onerous contracts that are being entered into by our public libraries. And in the middle is caught our taxpayers and our government. We're caught in the middle of this confluence right here, and that's what this is trying to solve. And it is as simple as that. Just to maybe assuage some of the thoughts and concerns of Representative Davids, you know, I did talk to members of the Rules Committee about this and the potential of seeing getting a post-deadline waiver if we were to get this across the finish line. I've talked to the chairs of this committee. I have tried to go about this as above board as possible because it has garnered bipartisan support, and it touches on issues that both of our parties really, really care about. And so, when I saw Representative Reimer walk out the room, I kind of had an idea of how this is going to go today. But the fact of the matter is that if there are those of you that maybe have some concerns about the minutiae of the bill that we want to work on after this gets laid over today and voted down, I would be more than happy to talk to anybody on either side of the aisle here to try to hammer that out, because this is an issue that we do need to address. So I just want to say before you all take this roll call vote, that is an open invitation from me to do so in a bipartisan way, as I have done through every committee and in my conversations with your colleagues and the GOP House Caucus as well. That is my word to you. And with that, Madam Speaker, Madam Chair.
Retiring, remember?
That's right. I appreciate the discussion today. I appreciate you hearing this bill. I think it is an important discussion, and I look forward to seeing the results of this vote. The work continues, and you have my word that I will continue working on this with anybody who is willing to work with me on it.
Thank you. Representative Katiza Batun, would you still like the roll call vote?
Madam Chair, I think in this tied situation, it's helpful to know how many votes that we have so that we can skip the whole rigmarole of asking for a division after the fact when we don't call a roll, and then we need to find out how many votes there are in order to pass the bill out of committee. It wastes committee time. It is silly.
Okay.
I don't think it's partisan, because we're all elected as partisans, and if you are afraid to have your vote on the record,
we will go ahead with the motion to call the roll. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Co-chair Cagle votes aye. Co-chair O'Driscoll?
No.
O'Driscoll nay. Co-vice chair Elkins?
Aye.
Elkins aye. Co-vice chair Perryman?
No.
Perryman nay. Representative Allen?
No.
Allen nay. Representative Buck?
Yes.
Buck aye. Representative Cha?
Aye.
Shaw, aye. Representative Davids?
I'm scared, but a no.
Davids, nay. Representative Dotseth?
No.
Dotseth, nay. Representative Falconer?
Yes.
Falconer, aye. Representative Finke?
Yes.
Finke, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Heintzman?
No.
Heintzman, nay. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Katiza Watun?
Aye.
Katiza Watun, aye. Representative Kreisha?
No.
Kreisha, nay. Representative Reimer is excused. Representative Smith?
Aye.
Smith, aye. Representative Van Binsbergen?
No.
Van Binsbergen, nay. Representative West is excused. Madam Chair, there are 10 ayes, 8 nays, and 2 excused.
10 ayes and 8 nays. The motion does not prevail. Sorry about that, guys. All right. The next on the agenda is just this, my bill, which is 4544. And this bill is just, we're going to be laying it over. And so the best way to explain this bill is that, when I worked at a nonprofit, we did something called a service enterprise. And so this was a qualification, for our organization to go through the steps to ensure that when somebody was donating their time or their money to our organization, that they knew we had the capacity and the skills to manage this. And so this would be kind of the same thing as a certification program for AI. And so with that, I would just like to have my testifiers speak to the bill, give their little presentation about how this would work. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hey, good morning. Can you all hear me?
We can.
Great. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Barmore, and I'm here today on behalf of Fathom. Fathom is a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to building practical, innovation-forward governance frameworks for AI. We are entirely philanthropically funded, and we have no financial ties to big tech or any countries of concern. We're simply here today because we believe the Independent Verification Organization, or the IVO, governance framework is the best approach to ensure that AI products are safe for consumers, families, and businesses while still encouraging American innovation. Minnesota has an opportunity to prove this through the House File 4544 proposal before you today. Many AI accountability proposals we've seen considered here and across the country follow the same pattern. Prescriptive mandates, compliance checklists, and in many companies, self-certification. House File 4544 takes a fundamentally different approach. Instead of command and control compliance, that is a list of rules that companies must follow, it creates a market for independent expertise where qualified organizations compete to provide rigorous verification that determine what AI products are safe, secure, and work as advertised. Government sets the outcomes in terms of what it wants with regards to AI safety. It oversees the IVO marketplace, and it also enforces the law. While participation for AI deployers and developers is entirely voluntary, in practice, verification from IBOs will become a competitive differentiator, and companies that earn verification will gain legal clarity that they have met a heightened standard of care. So as you can see in the bill text, the IBO model puts together a state-licensed, structurally independent organizations called IBOs, and these groups will evaluate AI systems against measurable safety and risk standards. They'll conduct ongoing monitoring and issue verification that regulators, companies, and consumers can trust. This doesn't replace government oversight, it simply scales it. I do want to highlight just three notable features of this framework. First, IBOs are meant to be outcomes-based, not a compliance checkbox. IBOs must define measurable risk metrics, conduct pre-deployment assessment, perform ongoing post-deployment monitoring, and prescribe corrective action when thresholds are missed. The point isn't to check a box. It is to ensure that real societal outcomes around child safety and other needs are actually being met. Second, IBO independence from industry is structural, not just aspirational. The bill text requires that IBOs demonstrate independence from the AI industry it seeks to verify. It also creates an advisory council where members have to avoid financial ties to the AI companies, and it also makes license revocation mandatory if that independence is compromised. Lastly, again, the bill provides legal clarity that creates a real market incentive. Companies that obtain and maintain IBO verification receive a form of legal clarity that they've reached a heightened standard of care regarding the safety of their AI system. Minnesota has an opportunity to lead the country with a model that protects consumers, encourages innovation, and can scale as AI becomes more widely deployed. I look forward to discussing House File 4544 and look forward to answering any questions you might have. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, are there any member questions? Okay. Well, I thought this was kind of a cool idea to think about, especially when we have, you know, all these artificial intelligence applications coming into play. The cool thing I thought about this is that we get to work together in setting kind of the benchmarks and or the benchmarks and the outcomes that we want to see as these tools progress. And so I think this is a really interesting idea that I would like y'all to tackle moving forward, because I think it's going to be really imperative that we do put guardrails around artificial intelligence and that we make sure that folks using it know what they're using. You know, this wouldn't restrict anything, but this would allow folks to understand the products that they are using. And I think in this time, we really need to start building transparency and accountability into kind of everything we do. And so any questions at all? No? Cool. All right. Yep. We don't plan on meeting tomorrow. There is a meeting. Oh, I'm sorry. And we will lay House File 4544 over. So no meeting tomorrow. We will be meeting on Thursday. I know that there is a governor's proposal for this committee that is supposed to be coming soon, as I'm looking at Mr. Smith. Okay. And so look forward to that language. And Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to make any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as the Chair pointed out, we will not be meeting tomorrow. We're in the fiscal part of the session. And we do not have a target. We do not anticipate seeing a target. I know that the governor has a supplemental spending bill that the governor would like to have money to spend at this time. Again, I don't know that the House and the Senate are meeting to put targets together. However, I will continue to work with the chair, and we've had a good working relationship to find out if there are any fiscal matters that would be in bounds. And if there are, we will bring those forward to the committee. But again, the policy deadline has passed on the committee at this point and in the time frame. I realize that sometimes things have policy and fiscal implications. And so we will continue to work with our counterparts to try to find things that we can continue to work on together. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. I will lay over 44, 45, 44, and this meeting is adjourned.